process. Johnson's border plans, if approved by the EU and British Parliament, would replace the so-called backstop proposals which played a role in sinking his predecessor, Theresa May's government. Johnson has vowed to bring the UK out of the EU, deal or no deal, by October 31st.
That is Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda. Friends and activists remembered slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi near Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul on the first anniversary of his horrific death at the hands of Saudi agents. APZ Donahue.
A memorial started at the time 1 year ago. The Washington Post columnist walked into the consulate, never to return. Post owner Jeff Bezos pointed out Khashoggi was getting documents so he could marry Hatice Cengiz.
You are in our hearts. We are here, and you are not alone.
Cengiz was waiting for Khashoggi outside the consulate on that day.
After a worst year in my life, I stand here, broken but proud.
1 year later, she wants answers.
What happened to his body?
Saudi Prince Mohammed says he takes full responsibility for Khashoggi's death, but denied he ordered it. I'm Ed Donahue.
The Trump administration's planning to expand the collection of DNA from migrants across the U.S. border. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Without saying why it's needed, two senior Homeland Security officials told reporters DNA collection will be expanded and the information will be included in a massive criminal database operated by the FBI. These officials did not say if the DNA sampling would apply to children who cross the border alone or to migrants who are seeking asylum. This collection would be separate from the rapid DNA testing to help determine if children are really with their parents. It's expected civil liberties groups will try to challenge this new DNA collection. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
More at VOANews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Thursday, October the 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe's main opposition leader outlines the way out of the country's current political and economic crisis.
We have said the political crisis in this country can only be sorted out when we have resolved the politics of our country.
Nelson Chamisa is the leader of the opposition movement for democratic change. Uganda's Bobby Wine tells supporters to defy a ban on wearing the People Power Movement red beret. Morocco aims to become the gateway to increased U.S. investment in Africa. And the Liberian diaspora is not happy with a dual citizenship bill awaiting President George Weah's signature.
I want to seize this opportunity to call on the President of the Republic of Liberia to allow that bill to die naturally on its way to his office. It is not in the best interest of his government, and it is not in the best interest of the Liberian people.
Arthur Weado is the National Secretary of the Union of Liberian Associations in the Americas, and the Tunisian women hope to secure a gender parity vote in this Sunday's legislative election. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Zimbabwe, the leader of the main opposition movement for democratic change has again said solving the country's economic problems rests on first dealing with the country's current political impasse. Nelson Chamisa reiterated that he won last year's presidential election, not President Emmerson Mnangagwa. In his State of the Nation address on Tuesday this week, President Mnangagwa pleaded for time and patience to bring the country's struggling economy back from the dead. But in this exclusive interview with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service, Chamisa says President Mnangagwa failed to articulate solutions to Zimbabwe's many problems.
We would expect under these circumstances where we have shortages of everything that there would be an adequate and articulation of what the solutions are around electricity, energy, around the almost impossible school fees, around transport costs that are skyrocketing, the prices that are going up in the shops, around issues to do with fuel shortages, around issues to do with basically the hardship that people are going through, but more fundamentally around the political challenges that have to be sorted out in this country.
They say it's easy to criticize. What is the MDC offering?
Any state of the nation address that does not speak to the current abductions, the current human rights abuses, issues to do with Dr. Makompei, you know, the abduction and the circumstances around his health, issues that do not address what happened to Gonyet, one of our, you know, artists who was also abducted, MDC activists, members of parliament who have been arrested, the political situation that is deteriorating, issues to do with pariah status and state that our country is currently is a state of the national address which is actually not indicating where the country is going. In fact, Mr. Mnangagwa was giving us his state of the mind instead of giving us the state of the nation. And his mind is clearly showing that there's disorder, there is turmoil, there's chaos, and there's no solution. We have said the political crisis in this country can only be sorted out when we have resolved the politics of our country. It is politics stupid. Until and unless we have resolved the fundamental issue of reaching a national consensus on what the problems are, we will not move forward. Legitimacy, legitimacy, legitimacy. There can never be economic reconstruction until we are able to come together and say this is the nature of our problem and this is the national consensus as to the answer to that problem.
But your critics are saying you and Mr. Mnangagwa are talking over each other. You are all saying you want dialogue. But why is it not happening? Why are you not taking the lead to engage him?
It takes two to tango. I can't force Mr. Mnangagwa to dialogue with me. I've told him that the problem that needs to be resolved is a political problem. It requires political players and actors. The people of Zimbabwe voted in July of 2018. They indicated their broad preferences. We won the election emphatically, and that is beyond any dispute. Of course, we went to the Constitutional Court. The court decided otherwise. We respected the decision of the court, but that does not take away from the determination and verdict of the people, that the will of the people was very clear. Mr. Mnangagwa knows it. His lieutenants know it, that they did not win this election. And the fact that they did not win this election makes it more even the reason why we should be dialoguing.
Nelson Chamisa is the president of Zimbabwe's main opposition movement for democratic change. He spoke with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service in Harare. Ugandan parliamentarian Rabo Chakulayi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, has told his supporters to defy a government ban on wearing the red beret, the official symbol of his people power movement. The Ugandan People's Defense Forces claim their uniform includes a red beret and that civilians should not be allowed to wear it. They say anyone wearing it will be prosecuted. Joe Sinyonyi, the spokesman for Bobi Wine's People Power Movement, says wearing the red beret does not contravene any Ugandan law.
The banning of the beret as we are hearing it from government, really, it is a fear by President Museveni. He's in panic mode together with his regime. They are in fear of people power because people power has risen as the political wave that is shaking up his government and literally going to sweep him politically. And so they are trying to find all avenues to cut our speed, to slow us down. And one of those is to try and delegitimize our symbol, our emblem, if you like, and that is the red beret. There's a very distinction, if you like, between the UPDF beret and the People Power beret. The UPDF berets all have the UPDF badges, that's the only badge. The People Power berets have the People Power badges, because our laws talk about the marks and insignias of the UPDF of the army, and ours does not have that. And in fact, we are telling our people, anyone who tries to wear the UPDF beret itself with the UPDF badge, that's wrong. But please keep wearing the People Power berets because you don't commit any offense.
But are you not concerned because the army said anyone wearing them will be prosecuted?
Well, we are wearing them. We are continuously wearing them. We are waiting for them to arrest us and prosecute us. As far as we are concerned, we are not committing any offense. And look, we are telling our government to measure on measures and to minor on minors. They like to measure minors and minor on measures. And so we are telling them, instead of wasting so much time and resources hunting down people who are wearing red berets, go and hunt down the people who are kidnapping Ugandans. I'm sure it's all on news. Yeah, almost every other day there's another young lady or another young man that has been kidnapped. Many of them eventually are found dead. and then so many other that are happening in our society, and we're telling our government, put the focus on that. Hunt down the people who are killing Ugandans. Hunt down on the kidnappers and so on. Those are the real criminals.
It says that one will be tried in a military court for wearing a beret. This is very serious.
Whichever kind of court they want to use, civilian court, army court, state house court, God knows what courts, we are ready. We are not committing any offense. And so we are continuing to wear our red berets.
President Museveni, he has ordered the salaries of the science teachers and doctors to be increased. What's your reaction?
We have been saying, look, pay people better, pay teachers better, pay the army better, and all of these different things. And then so he's trying to buy the population back to his side by doing anyhow what he is supposed to do. And we believe it's because of the torture we've exerted and the population has stand against him. And then so he's beginning to do a couple of things. The other thing that he did today, he issued a directive saying all the people that have been arrested for being idle and disorderly, vendors in the streets and all of these different people should be released. And all this we believe is because of the pressure that we have exerted. So an increment is a welcome move, and we are saying the same should go for folks in security forces, police and the army and all of that. It's a slight increase, and we are saying it can get better and it should get better.
Joe Senyonyi is the spokesman for Ugandan parliamentarian Bobby Wine's People Power Movement. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Thursday, October 3rd, Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. An official of the Liberian diaspora in the United States is calling on President George Weah to kill a dual citizenship bill that is awaiting his signature because he said it is not in the development interest of Liberia. Both houses of the Liberian legislature passed a dual citizenship bill this week. According to the bill, any person whose parent was a citizen of Liberia at the time of that person's birth shall be a natural-born citizen of Liberia. The bill goes on to say a natural-born citizen of Liberia may hold the citizenship of another country but shall not qualify for elected positions in Liberia. Arthur Weah-Do is the National Secretary of the Union of Liberian Associations in the Americas.
It is not in the interest of Liberians in the diaspora for the fact that when a country goes to war, when the country is struggling economically, it depends on its brilliant and professional pool living in the diaspora. But with the current bill stripping off all of the positions in government, including assistant minister and director, it is so disheartening. So I think the effort of having dual citizenship is to contribute, having Liberians in the diaspora, to when they be able to have their country developed from the ashes.
I don't know, maybe this is how people in Liberia see it, because the legislators are responding to their constituencies. The view there is that perhaps Liberians in the diaspora, you only go back to Liberia, and they claim that when you go back, you are taking away jobs there.
I have visited Liberia nearly every year, and from what I gather, I feel that the people did not understand what is transpiring in their representatives. So the notion that they have, indeed, it is the Liberian people who do not want for their sons and daughters who left the country because of the Civil War to partake in government. It is far, far, far from being the truth, Mr. Bote.
I guess you have an objection to the point that natural-born citizen of Liberia may hold the citizenship of another country, but you shall not qualify for elected positions. Is that the only thing that you're concerned about, first of all?
I'm not concerned about having jobs. I'm concerned about Liberians in the diaspora partaking in the body politics of their country. At this time in history, it is not only jobs. The private sector is open, but you want to something the putting feet to encourage Liberians to be able to go to their country of birth and contribute willingly, not with some restrictions here and there.
Again, this law is not yet law because President Weah now has to sign it into law.
Absolutely. The bill that we are need to sign. That is why I want to seize this opportunity to call on the President of the Republic of Liberia to allow that bill to die naturally on its way to his office. Let him veto it. It is not in the best interest of his government, and it is not in the best interest of the Liberian people. That law is selfish, it is draconic, and it will now serve the purpose for which Liberia needs at this moment, where all aspects of its developmental initiatives are needed, and people need to see natural born, well spread out in the diaspora, natural born to contribute to their country.
Arthur Weado is the outgoing National Secretary of the Union of Liberian Associations in the Americas. Officials with the Moroccan Investment and Development Agency say Morocco aims to become the gateway for increased United States investment in Africa. Mavis Ogeri has more from Washington.
African nations received $46 billion in foreign direct investment in 2018, up to 11% in 2017 United Nations figures. Nejma Helhuda Bouamama is department chief of Moroccan Agency for Investment Departments. She says the expansion of the country's Tangier net port would help her country become a key stop for investors and trading operations in Africa. Tangier net is the biggest port in Africa, and last year it handled 3.5 million 20-foot equivalent units of cargo. With the expansion, the figure is expected to rise sharply this year. Bouamama thus recalled for increased public and private sector exploration and trade investments in Morocco and Africa as a whole. She made the comments at an African investment forum at the World Trade Center in Washington. The forum strived to identify business opportunities and potential U.S. investments in Morocco and other African countries in sectors such as energy industry and finance.
We are eager to work for U.S. investments. It doesn't mean what U.S. can do in more Africa. Actually, we do have some U.S. investment, but it doesn't meet our goals and what because our relationship with U.S. are strong, are really good. So we think that we can do a lot with how to improve that, to do things better. But we should develop some good relationship here, as Ted communicates, more clear relationship, specific government to move forward. But we should let's say accelerate.
Mohamed Mukhtar also worked with the Business Development Department at Moroccan Investment and Development Agency. He says the country is strategically placed and have good infrastructure to serve different markets. He says the Moroccan government aims to diversify the economy to be resilient when economic problems hit.
We believe that we can be competitive. We can be what Mexico is to the United States in terms of car manufacturing. And the idea here is that we have succeeded to convince those constructors to establish their unit, production unit in Morocco. And around them, we have set different, what we call OEM, original equipment manufacturer, around them to supply their production chain. So besides that, we have very good, well-known car parts producers who are serving Peugeot, Citroën, and Peugeot, Citroën, Renault, and the other one. And they are serving also car manufacturers in Europe.
Among its advantages, Mukhtar says, is that Morocco has free trade agreements with European Union and the United States and several other countries, so it can import and export goods and services without duties. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
Women have made huge strides in Tunisian politics since the country's 2011 revolution and are hoping to make further progress towards gender parity in legislative elections this Sunday. But building on or even sustaining the earlier gains may be a problem, as Lisa Bryant reports from Tunis.
It's hard to miss Samira Shawashi this election season. She appears widely in the media as spokesperson for the Heart of Tunisia party, headed by jailed presidential candidate Nabil Karoui. But Shawashi is also running her own race in Sunday's parliamentary vote, heading the party's Tunis area list. It's been a long road getting here.
There used to be a political quota for women before the revolution, but they weren't always the right ones for the job. Now it's much more about competence. You have to fight within your party to be a leader.
So we don't have any difficulty to find, of course, women, female candidates, but to let the parties put them as head of list, that's the fight.
Tunisian women have long enjoyed rights rarely seen elsewhere in the Arab world. They captured nearly half of all seats in last year's municipal elections, and they make up nearly one-third of Tunisia's current parliament, compared to just one-fifth in the U.S. Congress. One big reason, laws requiring parity in party lists. Two women also ran for president this year. The capital, Tunis, has its first ever female mayor from the moderate Islamist Ennahda party. But women had less than 10% of Ennahda's list for these legislatives. There's no parity when it comes to ranking, and the party says it's hard to find good candidates.
We are unhappy, honestly, with the 10%. We'd like to do more, and hopefully in the future we'll do better.
Getting women out to vote is another challenge. Many are disappointed with post-revolution politics.
People are losing hope, and they are not so involved. They don't like to have another bad experience.
But Shawashi believes there's no going back. Tunisians are now comfortable electing women representatives, even if they may not yet be ready for a female head of state. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Tunis.
Teenage pregnancy is on the rise in Kenya as the country struggles to reduce maternal deaths caused mostly by young women securing unsafe abortions and miscarriages. According to the health ministry, use of contraceptives will help reduce the high mortality rate among young women between the ages of 15 and 24. Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
At least 40% of women in Kenya aged between 15 to 24 get unplanned pregnancy, which is mostly driven to by inadequate access to reproductive health, information and services, cultural and religious taboos, and poverty. Speaking during the launch of the Contraception Day in Nairobi, Kenya's Health Cabinet Secretary Cecil Kariuki said that meeting the demand for modern contraception and reproductive health is linked to the achievement of several sustainable development goals by allowing the participation of women in the labor force due to planned pregnancies.
I have a wish to reflect that despite of all these positive achievements, there's still issues that we need to cast our eyes towards and reflect upon. One is the increased teenage pregnancy, which continues to contribute in high maternal mortality and morbidity for this age set.
Use of contraceptives has been fought in Kenya by the Catholic Church as the government enacted the laws to have teenagers and young women have a right to access to health care. Ms. Kariuki says the health ministry is on the forefront to offer quality family planning methods to Kenyans.
Various counties already observed this important day by attending to various activities that all targeted offering quality family planning services to our people. This is indeed commendable, and today's event is further to augment the efforts already that have been made in the counties.
Cultural practices in Kenya are said to contribute significantly to weak implementation and monitoring of policy legislation. Tessa Matholi, the chairperson, Department of International Development under UKAID, said that millions have been spent to ensure easy access of family planning methods in Kenya.
At UNGA last week, the UN General Assembly meeting, we announced a new £600 million programme to support access to family planning commodities, reproductive health commodities, which will be largely channeled through UNFPA. So that's the equivalent of 78 billion Kenyan shillings. So that's a global contribution for many poorer countries to be able to access family planning commodities and should enable a further 20 million women and girls to access those commodities.
On the other hand, Ademalo Olajide, representative from the United Nations Population Fund, said that countries should come up with strategies to grow the economy through healthy family planning methods.
As we all know, family planning is very critical to national development. It forms a central piece within the development agenda, enhancing the health of not only women and children, but the well-being of the family as a whole. And the family remains a critical unit, driving the human capital that is necessary for economic development within the national development agenda.
In Kenya, oppositions from religious and community leaders has often prevented young people from accessing the information education and services that would enable them meet their sexual and reproductive health needs. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. In Zimbabwe, the leader of the main opposition movement for democratic change has again said that solving the country's economic problems rests on first dealing with its current political impasse. Nelson Chamisa reiterated that he won last year's presidential election, not President Emmerson Mnangagwa. In his State of the Nation address on Tuesday this week, President Mnangagwa pleaded for time and patience to bring the country's struggling economy back from the dead. But in this exclusive interview with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service, Chamisa says President Mnangagwa failed to articulate solutions to Zimbabwe's many problems. An official of the Liberian diaspora in the United States is calling for on President George Weah to kill a dual citizenship bill that is awaiting his signature because he said it is not in the development interest of Liberia. Both houses of the Liberian legislature passed a dual citizenship bill this week. And that's it for this Thursday, October 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
There today is Thursday, October the 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump rages against Democrats and a whistleblower who triggered an impeachment inquiry.
He's a lowlife. He should be forced to resign.
A solemn remembrance for a murdered Washington Post journalist. Also ahead, singer Debbie Harry, lead singer of the sextet Blondie, is out with a very personal new memoir. It's all on today's International Edition. During a news conference with Finland's president, U.S. President Donald Trump said Joe and Hunter Biden should be investigated. Hours after the president described him as a stone-cold crooked man, Joe Biden, the leading Democratic contender in the 2020 race for the White House, vowed on Wednesday that Trump will not destroy him. The back and forth came as Trump, first in a series of tweets and then at several news conferences, angrily denounced the impeachment inquiry concerning a July call in which Trump asked Ukraine's president to investigate Biden and his son, who served on the board of a Ukrainian company while his father was vice president.
He should resign from office in disgrace. And frankly, they should look at him for treason because he is making up the words of the president of the United States. Not only words, but the meaning. And it's a disgrace. It should not be allowed to happen.
And that he was referring to House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff, who is spearheading the investigation. Schiff later responded to the president's calls or comments and said that refusal to turn over documents and block witnesses from testifying will be considered accusations that are correct.
Any action like that, that forces us to litigate or have to consider litigation, will be considered further evidence of obstruction of justice. And of course, that was an article of impeachment against Nixon, the obstruction of the lawful functions of Congress, that is.
Trump also took aim at the whistleblower himself, who is protected by law from retaliation.
I don't care. Look, I think a whistleblower should be protected if the whistleblower's legitimate.
Schiff took the president to task for those comments as well.
This is a blatant effort to intimidate witnesses. It's an incitement to violence. And I would hope, and we're starting to see members of both parties speaking out against attacking this whistleblower or others that have pertinent information.
Now, joining us to talk about all of the events on Wednesday regarding the president and the impeachment inquiry. It's a fast-moving and unprecedented situation. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman joins us. Steve, what stood out to you?
Perhaps, Lori, the most significant was when the president was asked if he would cooperate with the requests that are coming from the Democrat-controlled House, which is conducting this impeachment inquiry, which wants documents from the White House and is threatening subpoenas. And although the president complained, saying that Speaker Pelosi is passing out subpoenas like they're cookies, he said that he always cooperates. So that was a very significant indication, although others in the administration, of course, are fighting this quite strongly, contending that this is a violation of separation of powers and is overreach by the congressional committees.
He also said some, as we heard in the clips, some pretty strong accusations against House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff.
Right. And Schiff is the Democrat who is essentially the point man now, appointed by Speaker Pelosi on this impeachment inquiry in the Oval Office. The president called Schiff a lowlife, said he should resign from office in disgrace, and frankly, they should look at him for treason. Again, very harsh and threatening words from the president, who is upset with a reading of the call memo that Schiff recited in Congress recently. Of course, that July 25th call between President Trump and the leader of Ukraine as really now at the center of this whole impeachment inquiry.
The president also indicated that he wants to, which we already have been hearing, target people involved with the beginning of the Russia investigation into the 2016 election.
Yes, the president threatening to sue people. Of course, the President Trump, both before and during his time in office, has frequently threatened lawsuits which never do appear. So I don't know how much to make of that. But again, what was at the heart of this phone call with Zelensky on July 25th and sending off his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, to Ukraine is really an attempt, which is based on conspiracy theories, to reverse the origins of the Russia probe that led to the Mueller report. And instead of blaming Russia, trying to blame the Democrats and elements in Ukraine.
Overall, what is your takeaway from the president? You've been covering him for a long time. You see him daily. Where do you think the president is right now with all of this going on? Because it would certainly seem that he's fired up, he's angry, and he's fighting back. But would this all indicate some concern or worry from him?
Oh, absolutely. There appears to be little doubt that this impeachment inquiry is going to turn into a formal impeachment. And although there are many Republicans and some in the White House who feel that he can use that as a badge of honor, in a sense, to campaign on and turn the election next year into that sort of referendum. But this is very serious. And there is a snowball rolling down the hill now in Congress, which is going to envelop all of the White House in the coming weeks and months and is going to distract the president and most everyone in the West Wing. So we cannot overemphasize how serious this is. And every day something else seems to drop and is going to result in subpoenas and people going up on the Hill like Secretary Pompeo. And we're going to see this week also a number of people, diplomats who were connected to Ukraine coming in to testify. And some of that could be damaging to the president. However, Trump, when he gets hit, comes out swinging. and he'll throw a lot of punches. A lot of them will miss, but sometimes they tend to connect, and they do resonate with his base. And that's what this is all about. He just needs to maintain his base in the eyes of the Republican strategists to get reelected. And all of this could indeed energize this base. So a lot of Democrats will also acknowledge that this really is a double-edged sword.
He seems to be telling his base, don't believe what you see and hear in the news and just believe what I say.
And a lot of them do.
Right.
So they have a tremendous distrust in the mainstream media. They believe when the president tells them that what is being reported by reputable news organizations is a fake news. And they read a lot of things on the internet. And as has been demonstrated, some of that comes out of Russia and reinforces this narrative and the conspiracy theories, and is obviously very frustrating to a lot of mainstream reporters. But that's the environment that we're in currently.
That's VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Meanwhile, the president's personal attorney, who is not a member of the administration, is also in potential legal peril for his role in all of this. And for that part of the story, we're joined by Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Why is his attorney not making sure that he's not coming out in the public and saying things that could further incriminate himself, or is there some other strategy here that we're not seeing?
No, I don't think so. I find it surprising. I think almost any lawyer would tell you that his or her first responsibility is to make sure that his or her client stays out of trouble. And I just find it ironic that the Mueller report, which, you know, tended to be quite temperate, more temperate than the Democrats had hoped it would be, but certainly quite temperate. You know, he followed Justice Department regulations and guidance about indicting a sitting president. He laid out all the possible ways that the president obstructed justice, but didn't reach a conclusion. And he concluded that there was not enough evidence to show a conspiracy among the campaign folks to obtain information from the Russians. So right after the president dodges that bullet, within a couple of months, he's on a phone call to the Ukrainian president, encouraging him to, quote, do me a favor. And then, of course, Mr. Giuliani is sent to meet with various officials to Ukraine. I think he met with them in Paris and I think in Madrid. But in any event, why would a lawyer whose client has just gone through this near-death experience not say to his client, look, this was a really close call. Let's count our lucky stars. But please don't call any other presidents asking them to do you a favor.
Well, it seems from all indications that Mr. Giuliani actually put the whole idea into the president's head about this conspiracy about Joe Biden and his son and was encouraging it.
You may well be right, but what's not clear is that whether Mr. Giuliani suggested to the president that he actually raised this in a phone call with the president of Ukraine. In other words, he could have been saying, yeah, you know, Joe Biden's corrupt and all that, but without going so far as saying, and by the way, raise this.
It's a little confusing because Mr. Giuliani is his personal attorney. So if he's working for the president on a personal basis, isn't there a conflict there if he's also doing national security business? Or
it's unclear. Presidents have often had people on the side whom they consulted with. But I don't think that that's really the core of the problem. There really isn't a conflict. There's always concern that the private counsel, in this case Mr. Giuliani, is going to get crosswise with government officials, meaning people in the State Department, and apparently that has happened.
Several House committees have subpoenaed Mr. Giuliani for documents.
Yes.
What happens if he does not comply?
Well, there are sort of two ways to go. The traditional way is go to court and get a court order. Mr. Giuliani is going to claim attorney-client privilege, and that may hold because he is a private attorney. The other way, the draconian way, send the Capitol Police out to arrest him and detain him until he provides the subpoenaed materials. That's effectively a kind of a civil, that is effectively what's called in the judicial world, civil contempt.
All right. Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Thanks for being with us. hear some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The European Union says Britain's new Brexit plans are not good enough. Iran and Saudi Arabia are reportedly in contact despite official Saudi denial. The World Trade Organization awards the U.S. a record $7.5 billion in a dispute with the EU. And a church where you can drink beer. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Marking the one-year anniversary of the killing of Saudi dissident and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi Wednesday, the United Nations Special Rapporteur and Khashoggi's fiancé both warned the international community that only action, not words, will send a message that no one can get away with murder. VOA's Ramon Taylor reports.
On October 2, 2018, prominent Saudi dissident and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S. resident, entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, never to return. Audio recordings assessed by Turkish intelligence suggested Saudi agents had possibly injected a sedative and suffocated Khashoggi using a plastic bag before his body was dismembered. But calls for accountability at the top went unanswered.
What if this was done by another country? What would happen then?
In a recent interview with VOA, Turkish author Hatice Cengiz, Khashoggi's fiancée at the time of his disappearance, said she believes the U.S. and Saudi Arabia's existing oil and arms deals ultimately led to Khashoggi's case being ignored.
We need to send the message to the world that political and economic power in controlling vast energy sources shouldn't be enough to get away with murder. Many countries failed this test.
Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard, author of a UN report, determined in June that the state of Saudi Arabia was responsible for premeditated execution in Khashoggi's death and called for Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, among other high-level Saudi officials, to be investigated. In December, the U.S. Senate unanimously approved a resolution calling Salman responsible for the death of Khashoggi. But the president defended the Crown Prince, saying the U.S.-Saudi relationship was too lucrative to end.
They've been a terrific ally. They're creating millions of jobs in this country. With that being said, I'm extremely angry and unhappy about a thing like that taking place.
Just 10 days after the release of the UN report, leaders gathered at the 2019 G20 summit in Osaka, Japan, where some embraced Salman.
I took that exhibition of friendship for the Crown Prince as a slap in the face of the killing, of the findings of my report, and of all those around the world that are facing attacks for their independence of mind.
11 Saudi suspects are now standing trial. 5 of them could face the death penalty. But Kalamar says the Saudi trial, being held behind closed doors, fails to meet international standards. She has called for next year's G20 summit, scheduled to take place in Riyadh, to be relocated or otherwise replenish the legitimacy of Saudi Arabia. She and Cengiz warn that world leaders' actions or inactions may determine the fate of others, such as Khashoggi, in the months and years ahead.
Khashoggi was the kind of person that gave the U.S. the message. Look, someone like this can also come from the Arab world. So the murder of such a person is like killing those who think like him.
Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
English-speaking Cameroonians on Tuesday celebrated what they call their Independence Day, declared by separatist leaders in 2017, as clashes with Cameroon's military left at least 9 people dead. The celebrations took place as dialogue ordered by President Paul Biya to solve the separatist crisis was taking place in the capital. The 3-year conflict to break away from the majority French-speaking Cameroon has killed almost 3,000 people and displaced tens of thousands. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more.
Hundreds of English-speaking Cameroonians gather in Kumba, carrying blue and white colors they call their national flag. They sing that they will fight until Cameroon's President Paul Biya and the international community grant them the right to self-determination. Among them is 31-year-old Godlove Azeng, who says October 1st is their Independence Day.
We are celebrating our independence and at the same time asking the president of Cameroon, Paul Biya, to remove his military from our territory and asking him to free our leader, Ayok Tabe, who is jailed in his country.
Julius Ayok Tabe is the separatist leader who was arrested in Nigeria with 47 of his supporters and extradited to Cameroon in January 2018. In August, he was given a life sentence by a military tribunal in Yaoundé that found him guilty of crimes including secession and hostilities against the state. October 1st this year marked the second anniversary since separatists in Cameroon's northwest and southwest regions proclaimed an independent state they call Ambazonia. On the very same day in 1961, the former French and British colonies of Cameroon were united to form today's nation. Separatists say they no longer want that union. During today's celebrations, 9 people were reported killed in gun battles with the military in Kumbo, the northwest villages of Kikaikom and the southwest towns of Kumba and Mamfi. Deben Chofor, governor of the English-speaking Northwest region, says government troops are deployed to protect citizens and Cameroon's territorial integrity.
Most of those areas have been secured by our security forces. Cameroon is ruled by laws and regulation, and we are going to take our responsibility to secure the villages. And while waiting, I'm asking the population of the Northwest region to remobilize themselves.
President Biya ordered the national dialogue that is currently going on in Yaoundé. Separatist backers who live outside Cameroon refused to attend, demanding the government first release their leader, Julius Ayok Tabe, and accept negotiations led by the Swiss government. On social media, they say no talks can start until Biya withdraws troops from the English-speaking regions of Cameroon as a sign he has accepted their independence. Political analyst and U.S.-based Cameroonian Humphrey Nsonka, who is taking part in the national dialogue, says it is unfortunate Cameroon is not doing enough to quell the anger of English speakers in the country where French is the majority language. He says the best option for Cameroon is a federal state, a concept the government rejects, proposing decentralization instead.
The huge numbers of people that came out in almost all the villages and towns is an indication of how English-speaking Cameroonians are disgruntled with the domineering attitude of the French majority. I think Cameroon should consider a federal state with Anglophones in one part and French speakers on the other.
The UN reports that the separatist war has forced more than 530,000 people to flee their homes since the conflict erupted in late 2017. It says at least 2,000 civilians and 300 defense and security forces have lost their lives in the war. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Kumba, southwestern Cameroon.
And you're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
The VOA's International Edition continues. 30 years ago, a deadly hurricane ripped through the beautiful city of Charleston, South Carolina, destroying many of its historic homes and buildings. A shortage of skilled artisans meant it took years to rebuild. Today, a generation of aspiring artists is learning traditional building skills at a local college where job placement is 100%. VOA's Julie Tabot traveled to the fast-developing coastal city to see how students and faculty at this unique college meet a growing and urgent need.
Alex Fisher grinds down an iron door handle. Jeremiah Price uses heat to soften the metal in his. Stephen Fancelli prefers working with wood. But all are enjoying the hands-on aspect of a special school in South Carolina.
I saw the school on a TV show, and my thought was, well, I wish I had known about this 10 years ago when I was actually looking at schools. And I decided to just make a change and come here.
The school is the American College of the Building Arts in the historic city of Charleston, which offers students intense hands-on training in traditional European craftsmanship. It was created after Hurricane Hugo ripped through this coastal city in 1989, destroying countless homes and historic buildings. In the aftermath, there was an urgent need for experienced artisans who knew how to rebuild the city, but there weren't enough of them. So it was a perfect opportunity for a traditional building arts school, which is the first and only four-year college in the country to offer such a program.
It's different and unique because we have blended a liberal arts education, you know, the critical thinking aspect of that, with a skill set that we teach six different skilled areas, so that a student leaves here with the art and the science of either preservation, quality construction, and the skills to be able to do it when they leave here.
Students also work off campus on local community projects. At this backyard garden in a residential area, students are building a children's playhouse using all natural materials.
So we are building with a method called rammed earth, which is a sustainable building method that goes back 7,000 years. The class is a hands-on building course where we try to give back to the community.
President Broadwater says that sense of community is important to the college.
We touch so many places and so many people, public projects that enhance the beauty of this city or state. The students are proud of actually producing something. That's why they came here. And so they can sit there and say, I made that.
Let's just put the soil right there.
Simeon Warren has been teaching at the college for 18 years.
You're working on 250-year-old monuments. The value and worth of that means you don't want to make any mistakes. That sense of worth for a person, I think, to actually know that their work is going to survive hundreds of years.
Perhaps that's why so many of the students are getting job offers even before they graduate. Lee Yarbrough has been working at this historic cemetery, helping to restore and stabilize several crumbling tombstones.
I actually already got a job offer last week, so, and he was like, let me know if anyone else is interested in hiring you, because I'll be competitive. So there's just a lot of opportunities after this.
30 years after Hurricane Hugo, Charleston is thriving. But should disaster strike again, members of its artisan community are well prepared. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Charleston, South Carolina.
Singer, songwriter Debbie Harry, lead singer for the pop new wave band Blondie, which was wildly popular in the 70s and early 80s, is out with a new memoir called Face It. In the book is an intriguing window into the musician, often thought of as mysterious. The book talks about sexual assault in her life, drug abuse, relationships, and what it was like to rise to stardom. And in an interview with ABC News, now she is asked what her parents thought of the life she chose as a rocker.
I think that they would have been happier if I had, you know, married and had a family. I have little regrets, but how could I possibly think or say that, because, I mean, everybody wants to, you know, have a life like mine.
Harry is now 74 years old. Her book includes photos and artwork related to her close to 50 years in the spotlight. Listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. House Democrats continue working to prepare a subpoena that will be sent to the White House Friday, unless documents about Ukraine are provided before then. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
House Oversight Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings is telling committee members the drastic step of a subpoena is needed because the White House has ignored multiple requests for information, and the whistleblower complaint provided urgent warnings that evidence could be lost. The subpoena will be directed toward Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, requesting 13 batches of documents related to the July conversation between President Trump and the President of Ukraine surrounding dirt on Joe Biden. President Trump tweeted his thoughts using an expletive to show he feels the investigation is bogus. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
The United States has won a record $7.5 billion award over illegal European Union subsidies to airline builder Airbus. This is the largest arbitration award the World Trade Organization has ever handed out to a complaining party. As a part of the penalty against the EU, the United States will start imposing stiff tariffs on a wide range of European goods exported to the U.S. starting October 18th. During a White House press conference with the president of Finland, whose exports would be affected by the tariffs, President Trump called the WTO decision a big win for the United States, saying the WTO wanted to make sure that he's happy. The WTO's decision is final and cannot be appealed. But the EU issued a statement from Brussels saying if the U.S. decides to impose WTO-authorized countermeasures, it will be pushing the EU into a situation where we have no other option than to do the same. This is VOA News. Britain called on the European Union on Thursday to be creative and flexible on Brexit after Prime Minister Boris Johnson made a last-ditch offer to strike a deal over the Irish border. More from Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda.
In a public letter to EU leadership, the Prime Minister calls for a regulatory zone to span the entire island, both Northern Ireland and the Republic, which will govern all trade goods. To avoid border checks, he says a declaration system would be introduced for small business traders, along with a trusted traders program to speed up the process. Johnson's border plans, if approved by the EU and British Parliament, would